This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com. Enter offer code PEL at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful.
You're listening to The Partially Examined Life. This is part two of episode 116 on Freud on Dreams. If you haven't listened to part one yet, go do that before you listen to this. It's not going to make a lot of sense. Now, to sum up where we were, we had given an overview of the book. We talked about the first half of the procedure for interpreting dreams, which is for the patient who has written the dream down to come in and cut the dream into pieces, and then for each element in the dream to just free associate. And then eventually those free associations are supposed to get to something significant. So the example dream that we were talking about, this woman who was making moves on Freud at a dinner table, this woman that who in real life he didn't care one fig about. And Dylan had just brought up the point of how can we tell this kind of dream from the kind that actually involves repression of something truly sinister?
Yeah. So, I mean, what's the difference between a dream in which there are repressed thoughts that the dream work has put into the latent content of the dream and a dream where the latent content doesn't have anything to do with repressed thoughts or impulses?
And I think, Seth, you wanted to start off responding to that.
So, Dylan, one of the ways in which Freud says we can distinguish between which dreams have some kind of significance and which are simple, in your terms, which are the running through the field dreams and which are the ones, the Oedipal dreams. He says in On Dreams that there are basically three different types of dreams. There are the ones that are intelligible and clear, meaning the dream itself has a structure which makes it intelligible, and the meaning and the associations with your waking life are very clear. Then he says there's the intelligible but perplexing, meaning the dream structure itself is clear. You understand what was happening in the dream, but you don't understand the significance of it. And then there's the unintelligible, which the dream itself and its association is also confusing. And he says, of course, there can be mixtures of different aspects of these dreams, but the suggestion was in On Dreams that the intelligible and clear dreams, because the mechanism of dreaming is wish fulfillment and the mechanism of dream work is obscuring and all that in the service of repression, the more clear and straightforward the dream is, the more you can suspect that there isn't actually anything behind it. There's a certain kind of prima facie experience of the dream which lets you know whether it has some significance or not. So if it's something that you easily understand and that makes perfect sense, the chances are very good that it's not one of those deep repressive dreams. It's just straight up,
I'm hungry.
I'm hungry.
And I think we've all had these types of dreams, right? Where we have to go to the bathroom and we're going to the bathroom in the dream, or hungry and eating in the dream. And he gives, you know, for him, children's dreams are paradigms of this, where they're simple, straightforward, they want something, and they dream about it.
So this is a good point at which I think it would make sense for me to point out, I do not remember dreams. I'm speaking as if, but the only dreams I ever remember having are either those kind of half awake, half asleep dreams you have, you know, or I have had zombie dreams where I'm being chased by zombies.
Oh my God.
And I can't, no matter how hard I run, no matter how fast I run, no matter how much, I just can't seem to escape. But otherwise, 99% of the days of my life, the nights of my life, I have no recollection of any dreaming. So in the sense that I brought up this notion that there's a kind of phenomenological approach that he's taking here, it's important for me to point out that I don't have that intuition. I don't have that experience that I can share with the rest of you guys on this.
It's funny that you bring up zombies, because I always find the stuff that's in horror movies is supposed to be the stuff of your nightmares, but that's never the stuff of my nightmares. Like, horror movies and fantasy are overlapped to me, and I'm not going to have a dream about griffins and dwarves and elves, and I'm not going to dream about zombies or vampires or any of that crap either. I dream about somebody getting hit by a car and regular people chasing me, not monsters, at least so far as I can remember.
Mark's nightmare dreams, instead of zombies and monsters, involve cubicles, fluorescent lighting, and a time clock.
I actually remember two dreams from when I was 5 years old, and both of them involved the supernatural. One of them a monster, and the other one a witch. Well, actually, I become the witch. So, anyway.
Some nice transposition there.
it's a little tricky because even though he does give these three types of different dreams, in a way, the dream example he's given in the beginning is of all three types. So there's an obvious, as Mark pointed out, obvious wish fulfillment in him. He didn't get attention from his wife. He has a dream where he gets attention from someone. So that's, in some sense, it's like the first, it has the intelligible part where there's an obvious wish fulfillment. And then there's the more bewildering part, which he's given an analysis of in this second section, where his conclusion is that it means something like, I wish I could get love with people without feeling indebted to them for that. So that's a kind of thing where your dream is somewhat bewildering and you give an interpretation which gets at a wish that's not obvious, but it's still not getting at the repressed thing. And then later on, he'll give us the interpretation that comes out of the confused and meaningless part of the dream, which is this idea that, you know, he regretted specifically having to give money to someone. So it's something he didn't really want to be aware of.
Even though at the time he didn't have the least bit of hesitation, he gave the money. He doesn't say straight up he was giving money to a loved one, but something with a loved one cost him. He had to pay out somehow because of that relationship. And he thought as he did it, and you know, that if the person was grateful, that it wouldn't be being grateful for free. That's what I thought. Maybe he felt like he was alienated from other people or from this person in that there was this economic thing that it was like he was buying their love. It's funny the way he puts it, that I think he says if there were gratitude, then it would not be for free. So he's not even saying there is gratitude.
We should look at the section, maybe. Or do we just want to wait till we get to it? Because that's at a later part.
I thought it was in this. No, I guess he just keeps bringing the same dream up.
Yeah, he brings the same dream up. And so I think where he gives the final explanation of the dream is in section 8. So the paragraph begins, I will test this on the dream specimen, which I chose for analysis. So this is, you know, he's given his whole idea of forbidden thoughts and repression, and now he's going to test it. So moving down that paragraph, I recall that my free cab drive reminded me of my recent expansive drive with a member of my family, that the interpretation of the dream was, I wish I might for once experience love that cost me nothing. All right, he's already given that. And that a short time before the dream, I had been obliged to spend a considerable sum of money on the same person's account. Bearing this context in mind, I cannot escape the conclusion that I regret having made that expenditure. So that's the final kind of coup de grace. That's the final nugget that he's extracted from the dream that gets at something that he had repressed.
And I'm going to interpret that as he paid her bail, just to make the story more interesting.
Yeah, so that's just an example of, you know, Seth was getting at the three different types of dreams and the way he's using one dream to represent all three types.
So I had thought that the first type of dream isn't necessarily the type that is harmless just because it has an obvious interpretation, that the obvious interpretation might be the secondary revision.
Or anything is a potentially a result of the dream work, right? Anything could be an obfuscation.
Right. So it seems like you really can't know. And that's one of the problems I was trying to resist throughout this whole reading. We were overdue to come back to Freud because the only time we brought him up in the last couple of years is like in the context of Thomas Kuhn saying that Freudism is very not scientific, it's not falsifiable, and then going farther in talking about hermeneutics, if you interpret this as a type of hermeneutics like literary criticism, then it, I don't want to use the word bullshitty, but that's the charge that's often made, especially when you get into the deep symbolism and, oh, everything has to do with infantile sexuality and sort of go into the more contentious pieces here. But even just the whole procedure that it, you know, obviously the dream vastly underdetermined, especially if you just took it as a text, right? If you took it like Dylan described as, we've got these five sentences and that's the text. And if you just want to analyze it, then it doesn't even matter how many heuristics you have at your disposal, how many other cases you've looked at, you're still not going to sort of for sure know what this dream means. And it seems that the model that he's sketched out is complex enough that there are always going to be multiple possible interpretations according to the model. So in the case of an obvious wish fulfillment, it could be that it's the obvious wish fulfillment, but it could also be that it's something hidden. So I think he's going to have to say that, well, just in a particular clinical situation, you're just going to have to spend a lot of time with the patient and see how this sits in with the person's other dreams, the person's other problems, that it's just, it's not going to be that easy. So I'm trying to be sympathetic to him by putting this interpretation into a larger therapeutic context. But I do feel like I'm taking his word for it. And if I'm going to do that as scientist to really then confirm this, I would have to look at the opinions of other experts that tried this kind of thing and were not simply devotees of Freud's and look at the subsequent history. And do therapists actually still use this kind of analysis?
Yeah. Well, there are plenty of psychoanalysts still using this, including my own. You know, it's really an art. I think Dylan is right. We should think of this more like interpretant literary criticism. There's lots of bullshitty literary criticism, but it's easily identifiable as such. And there's lots of really fantastic literary criticism, which is easily identifiable as such. There are good interpretations and bad interpretations, and often they kind of yell out at you what they are. It's not to say there isn't lots of ambiguity and polyvalence and all that stuff, but often within the context of an analysis, there's something obviously going on, at least to the analyst. Now, the patient may be repressing that enough that they're not aware of it, but an analyst who's been with someone for a few years has a pretty good window into what's preoccupying a person. And so you accumulate all this data. Again, it's not a scientific procedure that can be verified from the outside. It's not an experiment that can be replicated because you're dealing with an individual. You have all those sorts of problems, but that doesn't mean it's not a worthwhile way of knowing. It's tremendously worthwhile in certain ways. So,
did you buy his comparison in the revision of the theory of dreams to, you know, people have dismissed me. Someone in America, I refuse to admit my findings because you can't use experiments to verify them, but try that with astronomy. Ha, ha, ha. This was his, I think he actually said ha, ha, ha in there. It was a Bill Cosbyism.
Well, he's trying to get at the sense in which astronomy is observation-based.
Yes.
And you're saying, oh, look, isn't that interesting? There's Andromeda has this gas cloud around it, which they just found out recently. Andromeda is an individual, and you're characterizing that individual, particularities about it. That is part of astronomy, you know, in the same way that if you're getting to know someone as an analyst, and you are really, it's the science of that particular patient and their particular associations, their particular meanings. And so it's non-generalizable in that sense. So I think it's partially, that's an interesting point. But
I'm a little concerned, you know, I'm not a Freudian, I'm not an anti-Freudian, but I don't want to create a dynamic where Wes is somehow defending, you know, he's sort of the acolyte who's here defending the master, and we're taking potshots at him. The reality is that in that same dream analysis that we're talking about, Freud says there is a structure to how to approach this. He has a process where you take each individual element and then applying the rules of this analysis, you apparently go through the kind of routine with the patient where you're saying, what does this remind you of? Or what happened in the last day or 2 days that might be related to this? And each individual component is explored. So there's the woman, the hand on the leg, the comment, the eyes, all these things are intended to spawn off all of this. And in theory, there will be connections that you can make between the real world experiences that are associated with each of the individual elements amongst each other. So one element might spawn a few things, another element might remind you of a few things or might be associated with a few things, and you'll begin to see a theme or you'll potentially make connections between those things. So there is a process. The challenge in reading this particular example, and somebody on Twitter, by the way, when I posted that we were talking about this, said, it's all in the casework. You got to read the longer, all of the different case studies to get the feel for it, which is probably on the one hand true. On the other hand, what somebody who was defending Freud would say. Anyway, the structure seems reasonable to me as an approach. He has a very consistent, rigorous approach to this thing. The problem is when he gives us examples of himself and he says, so I was reminded that I took a cab ride with my friend and he offered to pay and I felt like I was getting something for free or I felt guilty about it. And then you go on for a little while and then he says, oh, and then I remembered that a week ago I shared a cab ride with my nephew and to whom I had just given a large sum of money, which just goes unexplained for whatever reason. And then he's talking about it's the convenient quote unquote remembering of these things that seem to fill in the gaps. This is where I feel like I get uncomfortable. There's nothing terribly outrageous about what he's doing or the approach he's taking. And I think if we were reading examples of documented cases where patients, where he said, the patient had this dream, I asked three simple questions, and they narrated this list of things, and then I was able to find these associations, there might be some sense in which it would feel maybe a little more rigorous.
Yeah, so there are lots of dreams on the interpretation of dreams. But I think with just one dream, you know, we spent we would never have time to talk about all those different dreams anyway. So one dream is enough. I'm saying that to the Twitter person, not to you.
When people go after Freud, this is the grounds on which they go after him. And I want to just be fair about where I think the lines can be drawn.
Well, so the way I articulated what you just said to myself is that it feels ex post facto.
Yep.
It feels like you made it up after you got to the end and added in stuff. And some of the things, the connections seem to be more manifest or more closely to the surface than others. And Mark gave some good examples of that in the dream that we were analyzing. And then others seem significantly further afield.
Yeah, when he says St. Paul is the innkeeper, that was just St. Augustine analyzed, the Good Samaritan. Wes is supposed to get it. He's supposed to come to my rescue.
My mind doesn't work that quickly. I was listening to Dylan.
Go ahead.
I think there's the aspect of some of the elucidations feeling ex post facto. And then there's the aspect of, well, there's got to be a whole cloud of associations that are going on. And these ones seem very particular. And it's hard not to feel like, well, there might be other just as likely interpretations that lead you down a different path.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems unwarranted, sort of scientifically unwarranted, to pick this one out of others, particularly, in fact, because it feels like in some of these cases, that's just so convenient. And I'm just trying to characterize the misgiving. I found myself thinking about this whole thing a lot because I really enjoyed the reading because of the way Freud writes, and both in the dream interpretations and then even some of the theoretical stuff, I'm witnessing him figuring things out. And the phenomena that he describes of analyzing somebody just walks and talks like a duck in this respect, that you don't know what's going on. You try to flesh out individual pieces, the breaking down of the dream and just really concentrating on individual images and individual sections. It's just like concentrating on individual parts of a system. You have a whole of some sort that you don't even really know why it's a whole, but it's just a whole prima facie. Why? Because you have a dream that's a whole of some sort. How does it fit together? What is it connected to? In fact, you know that it's a whole that is somehow connected to this person. And if there's one main assumption or piece that Freud brings in, it's that that dream as a whole is connected to that person in some non-trivial manner, that it's not cognitive noise, and that there's something to sort out there. And you're going to tease it apart by looking at individual parts of it and trying to see what more you know about it. And another piece that's going on is that those dreams, that activity of your mind in your dream is connected to your general mental activity, which includes all your memories, all your activities in your life, the things you were doing yesterday, the things you were doing a week ago, the things that happened to you 10 years ago, that they have the potential of being connected to one another. And you're going to try to just see what comes out of that. That's just the way of troubleshooting a system of a mechanical or electrical or physical system. Of you're a scientist in 1830 and you're trying to figure out electricity. You just throw some crap together and see what happens. And then these stuff happens. You say, well, stuff happens because it must be happening for a reason. So I'm going to try to figure out why it's happening. That's what he's doing.
Yeah. And part of the theoretical basis here is this idea that the reason why he's rejecting the randomness theory. So suppose you were to drop some iron filings onto a sheet of paper. Absent other conditions, you might expect a random distribution of those. But for Freud, the mind is this desire machine. It's that it's the very field. Fact. It's a field. And in the same way, if there's a magnetic field that we're organizing those filings, he expects something to work on those, on that randomness, and to produce something intelligible. And that has something to do with this highly associative nature of the mind. And people kind of are still on the same track with dreaming, right? They're looking at the functions of dreams and sort of deciding which associations are important and which aren't, for instance. That's one of the more current theories of what one of the functions of dreaming's. So paring away all the different projections between neurons, which aren't actually significant or useful, and just leaving what's actually significant or useful behind and consolidating memories, consolidating the good associations, and so on and so forth. So it's not all that different in some way. But I think with this idea of whether, okay, you know, is this the right interpretation? Couldn't you have come up with a million different associations? And that is a real problem, but I think it's the problem that kind of bedevils hermeneutics and interpretation in general. And I think one of the assumptions Freud is functioning on here is that it's not just desire in general, but something is on someone's mind in particular. And that thing that was on their mind while they were dreaming is going to continue to be on their mind while they're free associating. So what you're really doing is you're engaged in backward engineering. It was free association that produced the dream, and now I'm going to free associate myself back to the latent engine of the dream.
Here's my issue with that. This is not a theoretical exercise. So yes, there may be alternative interpretations, but the question is, how does this cash out for the analysand? How does it cash out for the patient? So Freud says, I have this dream. It doesn't make any sense. I treat myself as if I'm putting myself through analysis, and it comes out that I understand that I want love at no cost, or whatever the example was. How does that help him? What was the problem before, and how does the analysis help him change his behavior or reconcile himself to that? If this was presented in such a way that it was, I was aggravated, I was having a bad day, I had this weird dream, I analyzed it, came to realize that the reason I was aggravated was I had this unarticulated thing that was happening to me, and now I'm not aggravated anymore. That to me would be sufficient justification. It wouldn't have to be hermeneutic in that sense, right? Where you'd be like, well, this is one meaning and we can continue to proliferate meanings. If I was in analysis, I would not want 1,000 interpretations. I would want one that would help me get over whatever the fuck it was that I was having a problem with.
So you're pointing to kind of a pragmatic criterion.
Yes.
Which I think, and psychoanalysis is meant to be curative in the sense that you're reestablishing these links. People lose the ability to think about their own emotional lives. And instead of thinking, they let their body do the thinking, and they act, and they act in ways that are self-destructive. That's one way of looking at it. Or you have these symptoms and so on and so forth. You want to help people to mentalize their emotions, to connect their feelings and words so they don't have these symptoms or self-destructive behaviors and so on and so forth. But you're still left with a hermeneutic problem, because who says whether someone is cured? That's also a very complicated problem. We're not even cured, or just a little bit better, which because it's usually more of a gradual progression. Like in some sense, I remain agnostic. Things have gotten better, but I can't ever say definitively whether it was psychoanalysis that helped me. I just know that I believe in the principle of curative potential of human relationships. In a way, it's because I'm convinced by the mechanism than anything. So I think the theoretical idea that the mind is a meaning-creating machine and that it's helpful to know, or at least to try to know those one's own meanings, that hermeneutics is actually therapeutic, but it's not provable.
Also, just remember, he's not complaining of something and he's doing an analysis himself for that. He's the doctor. He's aware of these tricks that people play on themselves. Not that he then will be immune to all mental ailments, but you'd think that he would have some sort of more insight on himself. So he just says, here's just the dream from last night. So really the purpose of the exercise is to say something about the practice of dream interpretation and thus the structure of the human mind, and not necessarily to do something therapeutic with himself with this particular dream. At the same time, he says that we never waste time in dreams thinking about stuff that is useless. So if something seems trivial in a dream, well, that's because it must be hiding something that's significant, that you're always going to be, there's some problem that you're trying to solve. There's some wish that is bugging you that you're in a displaced way showing is fulfilled. There's something. So even when there's nothing apparently wrong, if you drill into yourself this way, you're going to find something that being able to bring it to the surface would be helpful.
Yeah, that actually seemed to me to be a less controversial claim, that anything that's not interesting to you when you're awake is not going to be interesting to you when you're asleep.
You would think the things that would be interesting to you when you're awake are the things that consciously you would say that is interesting. But I think a lot of the point is that there are unconscious desires that actually we would reject when we are awake. And we might even say that is not interesting at all. I don't care about that. And that's why we forget dreams so quickly when we wake up, is because we're like, wow, that's a bunch of bullshit, and reject that. But he wants to say that one of the big discoveries out of this is that there are unconscious thoughts and unconscious desires and unconscious wishes going all the time, that things are in fact interest me while I'm awake that I would claim are not interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like there's a dialectical way of following the chains here that it seemed reasonable in just the way you said it. So it must be something interesting. Oh, but then it subverts what we thought we were interested in the first place. So I admire the genius in it. I'm not going to dwell on it, but it does worry me that it is so tricky and self-undermining in the way that I was just describing, so that the task that he's placed for himself of untangling the webs that the psyche weaves just might be too difficult. That's really the upshot for philosophy, is that we have to, if you're, like we were saying in the Ricoeur episode, it's not just trying to be aware that is my religion of love actually hiding some underlying hate. Specific things from Freudian or Nietzschean analyses of the unconscious and the way people are passive aggressive, but just that in general, I don't know what I'm thinking. And so that undermines every philosophic act that I could have. I'm not sure what kind of, be on guard against that. There's no way to be on guard against that.
I don't see why it undermines every philosophical act, though. That's a kind of psychologism that, you know, 2 + 2 = 4, even if your repressed wishes got you to that conclusion. So it doesn't matter if our thoughts are determined by our brain or determined by psychological processes, Freudian or otherwise. That doesn't undo their ability to represent the world and perhaps to ascertain some truth about the world.
But isn't using that kind of example just a red herring?
I'm just saying that we've already encountered this problem. Just the idea that our thoughts are determined by brain structure, or the science of the brain, and are determined in some sense if the world is deterministic and all of that stuff. That if you think that our philosophical propositions are somehow undermined by Freud, you could already say that based on some more general argument about thought processes having some explanation. But I don't think that works, though.
Well, we brought this up in the context of Nietzsche, that Nietzsche was always ready to, instead of looking at the content of someone's philosophy, looking at how it relates to their character. And so the English moralists only believe what they do because they're uptight, petty little people. You know, that was his take on.
But if you have to have already shown that they're wrong, and then you explain why. It's an ad hominem fallacy, simply to say, they were like this, therefore their philosophical propositions are undermined. You can't say anything about the truth or falsity of any philosophical proposition based on the character of the philosopher who produced it. And you could explain why he was wrong afterwards if you already established that. But it's an ad hominem fallacy to think otherwise.
But isn't in most of the most interesting philosophical decisions we make, the fact that there are so many brilliant people that believe such varying things says something about how the facts underdetermine the interpretation of it. And one of the ways that, especially when it comes to something like ethics, there's a judgment call that's made. There was just a dispute on the blog in the light of the Schopenhauer episode of between people who were sympathetic to idealism and people thought that it was somehow self-refuting. And even though they were both giving sort of textbook representations of these arguments, it sort of came down to they just couldn't communicate with each other. Neither was convinced by the other. And you could say, well, that's because they're both going beyond the proper Kantian bounds of what knowledge is possible. And so, of course, if you do that, you're going to run into insoluble antinomies. Maybe that's the response. And that's where a whole tradition of philosophical quietism comes in. And we just shouldn't really be doing philosophy because we can't know this stuff and blah, blah, blah. But still, it seems more often we'll say, well, I have to live with some philosophy or whatever. And I know I'm speaking at a very high level of abstraction. I'm not sure how far we can chase this, but that I have to use my best judgment. And Freud comes along, and I think one of the lessons we can get out of this is that you might think that your best judgment is in some way rational, is in some way objective, that you can just do phenomenology and then anybody else who's in the same position will judge the same way. But I think if you take the Freudian critique seriously, then you will say, not really, that the way that I jump on anything is always going to be for reasons that are underneath and prior to my rationalizations about it. that that's just a primary structure of the human mind.
But we know that before Freud. I mean, if I'm thinking through a logical proof, or if I'm thinking through an argument, the words that are coming out of my mouth right now, they may be rational in some sense, but their causes can't be rational. Their causes are determined by brain processes. I don't know where they come from. You fall back on some cause that is dark and unknown to you. And that's the premise of Sam Harris's whole book on free will, where he thinks we can't have free will because he thinks free will requires controlling the process all the way down. And that if my thoughts don't always come from some rational source that I'm completely in control of, then I'm doomed. Well, of course they don't. Of course, what I'm saying now, however rational it is, it's not the result of my rational plan. It's the result of unconscious brain processes, and it becomes conscious to me. There's a broader undermining of consciousness. You don't need Freud for it. You just have to look at the fact that things are, at one minute it wasn't conscious, and now it is. One minute it was mere potentiality, and now I'm saying it. It emerged out of darkness, to take Sam Harris's metaphor. And I don't think that's actually as undermining as it might seem on the face of it. Because we still presume that the mind is in contact with the world, and that there's representation, and there's truth, and things like that. Which we know this. We know that in the broader sense, a large part of what goes on in the brain is simply unconscious. Most brain states don't have conscious states associated with them. And at any given time, my attention is on a very narrow window, right? I could point you to the way the seat feels against your legs right now. That feeling was there before you suddenly paid attention to it, but you weren't really conscious of it. So there are lots of things going on in your head that have corresponding brain states. Someone could show you that your attention simply isn't directed at them.
So Freud adds the extra complication of an explicitly independent teleological system, is essentially an agent that is acting within us, that we are the result of multiple agents. And what shows up in consciousness is this end result of the admixture of the action of two fundamentally separate entities within the mind. That seems to be the new element.
Yeah, he calls them agencies, not agent. I don't want people to think that he thinks there are philosophical people, that there are people or agents or homunculi or what he calls the demonic aspect. They're really just brain functions. If there's a sensor, that's just representative of inhibitory brain processes, which we know go on. I'm not sure why we would want to think of that any differently than that.
So I keep hoping that Seth or Dylan finds this overall question of the impact of the lack of self-knowledge that Freud says is interesting for philosophical reasons.
I think it's interesting. I'm not sure exactly where we're going with it. I have, on the one hand, similar misgivings about Freud as compared to lots of other things, and I articulated some of my own, but we haven't gotten to really discussing displacement and
the distinction.
Let's knock out the mechanisms.
I think for what we read, by far the most interesting and important stuff is that structure of understanding dreams that he comes up with. I think for a broader survey of the power and misgivings of Freud's theory of the mind, which isn't really here, except sort of pointed at or maybe slightly implied, as well as the deeper notions of psychology and what are the real motivating factors in the structure of our psychology, which are also sort of pointed at here and pointed at more in the revision of A Theory of Dreams. I think we have to, you know, read more.
So before we get into these, Seth, tell us about Squarespace.
You know, building a website can be tough. And even if you do know your way around coding, creating something that looks good and works well is a time-consuming affair. Whether it's for a business site, a portfolio, a restaurant, or whatever else, in this day and age, you probably need a website anyway. Well, lucky for us, Squarespace makes it easy to build beautiful websites without breaking a sweat. Squarespace provides simple, powerful, and beautiful websites that look professionally designed regardless of skill level, and no coding is required. Not only does Squarespace provide you with intuitive and easy-to-use tools to create your website, Squarespace also has state-of-the-art technology powering your site to ensure security and stability. And you know you can trust in Squarespace for your website needs when millions of people and some of the most respected brands in the world trust them too. Now, Wes, you used to be a web developer.
Yeah. I have extensive experience as a web developer, and I've built websites from scratch, and I also have a lot of experience with different content management systems, both coding them and using them. And over the years, the technology has really advanced, and Squarespace is sort of the preeminent example of that, just because it's
so much easier now to build great websites without coding. And for most people, with tools like Squarespace, it's simply a waste of your time to be coding websites from scratch. Squarespace is an amazingly easy interface for putting together a professional website.
That's exactly the point, Wes. You cannot beat the ease and simplicity of Squarespace. And they give you 24/7 online support for only $8 a month. You can even get a free domain if you sign up for a year. So what are you waiting for? Start a trial with no credit card required and start building your website today. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code PEL to get 10% off your first purchase and show your support for the Partially Examined Life. We thank Squarespace for their support. Squarespace, build it beautiful.
All right. Sounds good.
So I tried to outline early on that I thought this was a radical challenge for the traditional notions of self. But I think there's a couple things that are interestingly subversive about this. The first is the idea that the self is deluding the self. So not only do we not have perfect self-knowledge, but our attempts at perfect self-knowledge are not frustrated by limits on the apparatus of our own self-reflection. It's not as though we have some kind of epistemic limit to our ability to self-realize. It's that we're being intentionally deceived by ourselves, which is a kind of wacky and, I think, interesting look. The second thing, though, is that when we read the revision essay, he mentions that the repression mechanism is essentially fueled by the culture. Again, without having read 150 other things that I'm sure he's written and this has been discussed, the suggestion is that left to our own devices, we don't self-repress, that it's something that comes from outside, parents, culture, whatever. And that, he says, because our culture is especially repressive sexually, it's no surprise that what we keep finding is these repressed sexual things.
So can I just interject one quick?
Yeah, yeah.
To be a pedant. It's actually, there are two sources of the repression. So one of them is cultural, but one of them is internal. And that's just the fact that stimuli can overwhelm us and traumatize us. And so repression has that source as well.
Oh, so it's like a defense mechanism.
Yeah.
I think he calls it somewhere the principle of pain, that if we are going to feel too much pain, then we do something to stop it. And so if we can't run away, then we block it out.
Go ahead with what you're saying. I don't think that changes the general.
No, it doesn't. And I appreciate you clarifying that for me. So what I think is interesting is that that in itself suggests that different cultures or people that grow up in different environments and different societies, the mechanism is going to work differently for them, which again goes back to this idea of this whole thing being a hermeneutic approach, meaning that the interpretation is going to depend on the assumption that there's meaning in the thing to be interpreted, the dream, right? And the balanced participation of the therapist and the patient in working through and explicating, so to speak, the meanings of the text, but also understanding that that same dream as a text might have a different meaning when the patient is 10 versus when they're 30, and also simultaneously that people with different dream thoughts that are repressed, there's going to be a different take, meaning in a society where sexuality is not repressed, but something else is, the mechanism and the structure might be the same, but the dream thoughts that ultimately get resolved when you go through the analysis process might be radically different. In any case, what this means from a philosophical perspective is, I think, anything that has been built on the idea of self-knowledge and self-reflection, which does not simultaneously acknowledge that that process is not foundational, is not grounding, so explicitly anti-Cartesian, to refer to what Dylan said earlier, is going to be untrustworthy. If you think that self-reflection, self-consciousness, self-knowledge is somehow the key to some notion of philosophical identity, epistemic certainty, or, for example, in
the inner nature of the world.
Yeah. How about the will, right? How about my experience of myself as having some kind of consciousness is the lever in which I can get at the will, right? So just referring right back to the Schopenhauer episode, we just...
I don't see those two things as inconsistent, though. And we kind of had this discussion during the Descartes episode as well.
How do you even remember that?
Descartes is focusing on...
Because his mind is transparent. He doesn't...
the sliver of... And it's the same thing with the whole Sandel, as if Kant's focus on a transcendental superego didn't mean there wasn't such a thing as an empirical ego that you could do empirical psychology about. The Cartesian ego isn't all there was for Descartes, and the transcendental ego isn't all there was for Kant. They knew there was a larger, more interesting, meaty empirical ego that you could do psychology with. And also, I don't think this isn't something interesting about what Freud's doing and the way in which we don't know ourselves. But this idea that we don't know ourselves is an old one, right? You know, that's the Socratic mandate, is to the unexamined life is not worth living. But you're getting...
Getting rid of bad opinions
and doxosophia for Socrates is related. It's a therapeutic... Dialectic is therapeutic, and it's meant to rid you of these bad things. There are lots of analogies between that and Freudian psychotherapy. I agree. The way we don't know ourselves, Freud is fleshing it out in a whole new way. But this idea that we're ignorant of ourselves and we have to come to know ourselves, I don't see that as a new thing.
The big difference that I liked the way Seth articulated it is that there seems to be a world of difference between we don't know ourselves and we have to do work, even therapeutic work through philosophy or whatever it is, to get to know ourselves and get to know the world. And the idea that we are hiding from ourselves, that we are putting barriers in the way of ourselves. So that changes the dynamic from being one between passion and intellect, or between lack of understanding that then by shining a light upon it becomes understanding. It's a different kind of work that has to get done.
But look at the crappy opinions. So for the Socratic interlocutor, look at what he's doing with them. They have a bunch of dumb stuff they believe, and he's trying to help them to see that those opinions aren't even consistent with each other, blah, blah, blah. They think they know the truth about something. And a lot of that stuff is normative. A lot of that stuff is ethical, but it's bullshit. If you went farther, you could give a psychology of the need. You know, a lot of that, it's implanted by culture, right? And you could give a psychology of why these people believe these things, the cultural reasons. And then if you go farther, the fundamental social forces and psychological reasons that would lead to such beliefs. Why is sexuality repressed in the society? It's not an accident that it occurs across most cultures. There are fundamental psychological forces that make that happen. So there are two ways of approaching certain kinds of false beliefs about the world, and there's two different levels of generality. I might just have, on a very general level, these bad ethical ideas that a society has instilled in me, and then some sort of therapeutic dialectic will help me get rid of those. But on a more specific level, I might have these very specific opinions that are reflective of my own particular psyche, that I haven't just borrowed from culture, even though culture has a big part in forming what they are. So if I have some maladaptive belief about my identity and who I am, and that's something that a psychotherapeutic technique might help me understand. You guys see some of the overlap. Yes, they're very different, but there are some interesting connections. And one day maybe we'll read Jonathan Lear on all these. He's the philosopher who tries to make all these connections between Freud and Aristotle and Socrates. And
so I'm glad you finally all took my bait to try to discuss the overall philosophical point. Wait, really, I just want to throw out a distinction that is comparable to one that we've talked about before. So we've talked about skepticism about specific things versus global skepticism. And there are a lot of people that want to say, of course you want to be a good scientist and be skeptical about specific things, but that doesn't mean that any sort of permanent Cartesian doubt about everything is in any way warranted, or a lot of folks argue that it's not even coherent in some way, that we have to assume that most of our beliefs are true in order to make sense of the world at all, something like that. So here's a parallel case in which I think Freud is going to want to say ways to take the input of Freud into the hermeneutics of suspicion, as we discussed it in our recent Ricoeur episode. You might want to say, as a methodological point, if you are making a specific argument against, say, I think homosexuality is immoral, just to take a really easy one, then, well, maybe you want to do some personal therapy on exactly where the vehemence against that comes in. Is there some underlying fear about your own sexuality, something like that? So that's a methodological take that Freud can inform us and make us better decision makers. However, you could also take what I was trying to voice before, a more global skepticism, and say that Freud is really undermining any judgment call. Anything that's not strictly determined by the facts of the matter would determine your beliefs. Maybe there are none of those, but we like to think that if we see a logical truth, if we see 2 + 2 = 4, if we see any number of verifiable scientific, whatever.
Mark, you're falling into the psychologist trap.
I'm not arguing for it. I'm trying to say These are two different things that I've seen out there, objections made, and I would think that a lot of listeners in particular might take Freud as an excuse to become a relativist or something, and I think you've been giving pretty good reasons why you should not do that.
Yeah, I mean, go back to our Frege episode. The psychologist argument doesn't work. You don't undermine these things by giving the mechanisms or the genealogy of the thinking.
Right. So to pursue that any further, we would have to go into the specific, if you're investigating like Frege was, logical truths. Yes, I completely buy that you don't have to talk about human psychology because of Freud, certainly, or anybody else, to talk about logic. But if you are then talking about your choice between metaphysical systems, or you're talking about your choice between ethical systems, to me, that's more an open question. What's the difference between Nietzsche and Schopenhauer? I'm not convinced now that we've looked into Schopenhauer now more that Nietzsche bought into anywhere near Schopenhauer's whole metaphysics, but at least he expressed a lot of admiration for the Schopenhauerian.
Well, the will to power view is often taken as a metaphysical principle. But
yes. So let's at least even grant that he accepted Schopenhauer's whole system. He still then rejected the ethical portion of it and said, there's nothing that can make you become an ascetic to assert that everything is suffering and the best that we can really do is die. The only thing that would determine that is if you are sick, that there is something just in you that makes you make that judgment call. The most important questions in philosophy, that kind of judgment call comes into it.
It's a fallacy that Nietzsche's often been criticized for. You can't say someone, oh, that belief came from their sickness, therefore it must be false. It doesn't fall. I mean, I've said it before, but it's a fallacy. And you can say why. You could say, first, oh, they're wrong, and here's why. And that's where Nietzsche comes in, and it's great.
I don't think he's saying that the effective choice toward asceticism is false in any sense. It's just...
Or yeah, you could be an agnostic, you could be a Pyrrhonian skeptic on the matter, but then say from a practical standpoint, it's unhealthy. The truth or falsity doesn't matter. You could have that kind of position.
Or truth and falsity is not a characterization that applies to ethical or other things like that. And so it becomes a matter of Sartre is going to say, it's just your free choice. What do you want to live with? Or something like that.
All right. I think
all right, so back to the nitty gritty. Let's kick these things out. So dramatization, the first one I talked about already in terms of the fact that he maybe thinks that the latent thoughts are verbal. You know, I wish that I could get something for nothing, but yet to be put into a dream, they have to somehow get images. And he says how the optative has been replaced by representation in the present tense, the quote that you gave before, Wes. So he says a lot about how a sentence has prepositions and connecting words. Those get cut out, and some of them get cut out in interesting ways. The fact that there seems to be no or, that if your sentence would have, I want this or that, those are just smashed together in the dream. Or if two things would be stated to be one causes the other, well, that could be shown as one thing transforming into the other. So there are all these sort of tricks in the way these things get turned into images. And that's already bleeding into our other two mechanisms, condensation and dream displacement. But somebody else can talk about condensation.
So condensation, it's also called compression, is just the way in which overlapping entities get overlapped. And he says it requires that there be common elements in the components, and then they will then become interchangeable and lead to a set of composite structures that have multitudes of meanings that overlap with one another. So this is one of the reasons why you have to unearth what the meanings are in the dream analysis. So to me, the examples were, you analyze a dream, you end up finding these clouds of associations around them, and then find things that connect with them, connect one to the other. And you might even have, in the case of condensation, examples where the same thing is referred to by different images.
I know I've had that a lot with people, that he talks about in his dream, like that his wife has been swapped out for this woman.
Yep.
But I more get that, yes, it is my wife, but now it's my sister and now it's somebody else, you know, that just like from moment to moment in the dream. But I don't feel like, oh, there's been a transformation. It's just like, I changed my mind.
So the condensation in this case would be if there were more like an amalgam, like the qualities of lots of different people in your life or levels too, enter into that person. On a basic level, condensation, right, is just you're cramming together two different things into one image. So one of the examples he gives is of the swimming pool where people are running, except one person is trying to help another person out of the pool, which turns out to be a condensation of a famous painting and an experience he had had one day of seeing someone helping someone out of the pool. So it can be as simple as that. It could be that the sources of the condensed image are themselves perceptual experiences. But the sources of the condensation can be thoughts, they can be wishes, ideas. So you get a single image in the dream, and the idea is that there are multiple influences for this image.
I was struck again with the way he talks about fine art and classical literature and how these become elements in dreams and how starved these people were before there was TV.
I know.
We're just so glutted with images that I'm not going to reach back to a Monet that I saw at the museum for one of my dreams. It's not going to happen.
Right. Well, what TV shows are you watching?
I was there with Xena. And
yeah, really. Yeah. So you get these superimpositions of different qualities. One person could be your mother and your boss. Then they might have different qualities that show that.
And the thing I just said about there being no or when you translate from a verbal shows up in here, so that even things that are opposed that should be mutually distinct choices. And I guess I interpreted that there's no example given of this in the reading that I saw.
There is an example, actually. He gives an example of some flowers, right? There's a certain kind of flower meant to represent innocence, but then they were a certain color that represented sexuality. So you can have a complete contradiction within the same image. So some type of flower that's representative of virginity, but then it's red instead of white.
So I interpret the person is changing back and forth between my wife and my sister or whatever as being an amalgam, as opposed to there being an indeterminate but stable person that has qualities of both of those. And in the same way, I was interpreting this removal of or as even like, well, what's going on in the dream? Well, there's this thing is going on. You know, I'm in the middle of a bank robbery, but no, I'm at school. But somehow both of those, instead of it being or, somehow both of those are happening at the same time. And that's not disconcerting. This removal of the or goes very far into producing some very difficult to describe dreams, I think. That if you're going to describe it, you have to say, well, I was at school, but then suddenly I was in a bank. But maybe if you felt like that was not a sudden shift, then you were in the bank all along. And this is running to another problem when you try to recount stuff after the fact. If you can reproduce, since you're so unsurprised by sudden things that happen in the dream, if you can even reproduce what you were actually experiencing when you tell it later. He says, each element of a dream is overdetermined by material in the dream thoughts. It may be traced back to a whole number of elements, which need not be closely related to each other. So that's an interesting thing. So he says, like Dylan said, they must have some element in common. So at least the woman and his wife are both women. But then he says they could have nothing in common. But then what the sensor does, what some aspect of the mind does is sort of bring one closer to the other, alter the verbal form of one of them, for instance, and thus bring in halfway to the other. So the dream work creates these intermediate thoughts. And the example he gives is the German word kosten can be cost, like get without cost, but it could also be the taste of something, as in the spinach. And so that goes to that anecdote that he brought in about the little kid tasting spinach and how that has to do with parental responsibility. So I was a little unclear. He would only relate spinach to Kosten through his subsequent analysis when talking about it later, how he can say that in the dream itself, the spinach is an example of condensation.
That's exactly how it gets related, Mark. It gets related based on the analysis. That's the whole point.
Well, the dream work, he says, is forging a link between two different things. Exactly.
Then the analysis shouldn't be forging the link. The analysis should be unpacking the link into the two different things.
Yes, that's what it's doing.
So the dream work forges the link and then the analysis unpacks it. Yeah. What the dream work does is it takes spinach, it forges spinach as a link between what? Between cost and taste?
Yeah, that's what I was unclear, because there's nothing in the dream that's like, the taste only comes up in his subsequent analysis of it. So it's like it's linking cost, which was the thing that was ultimately at the bottom of the dream, which is not actually discussed in the dream, with taste, which is another thing that's not discussed in the dream. So I guess he's saying these are both things that were separate in the...
Well, it just has to connect the dream thoughts. So all it has to be... It doesn't have to be in the dream. It's just the cost and taste have to be in the dream thoughts and then connected in spinach.
What we were talking about is the dream work that combines these things. But if you're saying that the pun is already there just in the analysis and that in the dream itself, you don't even see them amalgamated at all, then I'm unclear how this is really an example of, but I don't want to dwell on that. He says it's the other way around works too, that each element of the dream is overdetermined by material in the dream thoughts. One thing in a dream can refer to multiple things in the dream thoughts, but likewise, each dream thought is represented by more than one dream element.
Right.
A dream element is the representative of all this disparate material. He actually says in the revision of the theory of dreams, it's as if it's something that's been elected.
It's a bunch of different influences leading to one thing. That's the election metaphor. A bunch of different voters, they settle on a compromise.
The elements of the dreams are like representatives chosen by election from a mass of people. Without more examples of the dream thoughts and the complexities of them, because he talks about how a full night of dreams, they're always related in some way. The different dream thoughts that are involved or the different elements of the dream thought have to do with the different ways that it's divided up. The first part of your dream is that you're running from the bad guy, and then the second one is that you're at school taking the test, and somehow one bleeds into the other. That's because those are getting at, I don't know if it's different dream thoughts or different aspects of the dream thoughts, but there's supposed to be a commonality in the whole thing, but that's one way to break it up. I guess that's just to point at that it's more complicated even than talking about one dream, that you're talking about the series of dreams over a night, you're talking about a series of dreams over time that a person has, lots of complexities.
Yeah, but the notion of condensation isn't that complicated. It just means you have a bunch of different things that are smashed up into one another.
Based on their similarities.
Yeah.
Similarities or constructed similarities, which I guess that was one of the questions, is what is the motivation for constructing a similarity when there is none?
So all the dream thoughts, you could think of them as preconscious, which means unconscious, not necessarily repressed, although they could be, but just they don't show up consciously in the dream. So there's all these dream thoughts which are seeking expression in some way.
To me, Mark is trying to point out the struggle with why these things are associated, and in particular...
Yeah, why would the intermediate link be forged?
Yes, and also in particular, in the example given, why that link seems to be particularly ex post facto. They seem to be so far removed from one another, it's hard to understand that they would actually be forged together by the dream work out of dream thoughts, because there's so little of them revealed in the actual account of the dream that it's really out of the interpretation. But I thought that the account of that was that the dream itself needs to be explicated by free association. And what you're doing there is somehow trying to get to the space of dream thoughts. And then when you make associations, when you see the pattern, see how they could be connected to one another, that is trying to reproduce some of the dream work. And so the conceit of it, you can imagine I have a gigantic bucket of all kinds of parts and complete disjointed things that are just from all over the place. And I dump them out on the lawn and I build a sculpture out of them. And I'm just picking things up and putting them together. And for whatever reason, any individual connection is just because, oh, look, here's a circle and there's another circle. I'll put them together. Or here's a circle and there's a square and I'll put them together.
But in this case, it's helpful to think of the force and the field example again. It's like two forces on something, and then there's the vector. So the two forces that are acting from the dream thoughts are enjoyment and cost. And they're looking for expression in the same dream image. So the single vector that's produced is this. Well, am I getting this right? Because I think the word for taste, right?
It's cost.
Yes, the word for taste gets you at both enjoyment and cost. So this concept of taste is the resultant vector of the two dream thought force vectors. But then it has to be imagized. It has to be dramatized as an image within the dream. So it becomes spinach. So I think that's the description of what's going on. It's two different forces showing up in the same concrete image.
when he dies, he's not going to say Rosebud. He's going to say spinach. So he'll unlock all the secrets.
He's going to say olive oil.
So the last one of the three is the dream displacement, which all these seem to bleed into one another. It was very hard to talk about condensation very much without getting into this.
Yeah.
But it's the psychical intensity passes over from the thoughts and ideas to which it properly belongs to others, which in our judgment have no claim to any such emphasis. And I understand that because that's how repression is saying, don't think of this, but there's energy imbuing that. So it kind of soaks to something else and it actually picks something from your day that doesn't already have something else occupying it. So it picks a person that you really just don't give a crap about that just was like an extra in your life and makes them important.
It's the same principles of phobia in which the psychical intensity, or the what he calls also the affective potentiality, gets passed from something that you're really afraid of to the pickle. Or you're afraid of your father, but it becomes a phobia of horses, which is actually an actual case that Freud had. So that's what's transferred. He uses this word affective potentiality, he uses the word potentiality and the level of the unconscious affect. Actual emotions are something that get expressed. So if they're not consciously being expressed, they're only potentialities in the unconscious. So hence this weird language of psychical intensity or cathexis, or you could think of it as electric charge. But this idea that it can get moved from one image to another, or one thing to another.
It's funny, though. I thought I was afraid of penises, but analysis uncovered that it actually was pickles that I was actually afraid of, legitimately. I was injured by a pickle as a child.
There you go. That could be it. You may have a phobia of penises that really refers back to pickles.
It's dialectical. It goes back and fucking forth. That's what's driving me crazy here. Any comments about displacement? Seth, I know you can't remember your dreams. Is there not displacement in your life?
Well, I'm sure there is. But actually, when I was taking notes on all of these aspects, I know there were the three major ones, but I wrote down a set of rules that were used in analysis, some of which I thought were interesting. Like, for example, you use logical associations to approximate time and space, and inhibition of movement is a conflict of will. There are some other ones. But a point he makes that seems so obvious after he said it, but I didn't think about it beforehand, that I think is interesting, is that he says, no dream is prompted by motivations other than egoist ones, by which I think he means we never dream somehow about anything other than ourselves, or that we are somehow always the protagonist of our dreams.
Or for the sake of our own pleasure and wish fulfillment and desire. I think that's the egoist thing.
Yeah. It somehow makes sense and at the same time is perplexing. If it's about wish fulfillment, would it not be the case that you could have a wish fulfillment dream where you were wishing for somebody else to get what they wanted? And yet we don't do that.
But you would have
apparently
to, you would have to want them to get what they want.
It's so meta, Wes. My wish fulfillment would be that my wish was fulfilled, that somebody else's wish was fulfilled. Anyway.
That argument about egotism and brings us down a rabbit hole, right? Because you can say even altruism is egotistically motivated because we get pleasure out of helping others and blah, blah, blah.
But I think this is supposed to be just something that he's found in analyzing people and not an a priori thing that he's like Hobbes saying, oh, everybody's selfish and we're just going to use that as a methodological assumption. Maybe he's doing that. But it seems like if you just looked at actual dreams, like, do people actually have dreams? Like, I dreamt that my son met the girl of her dreams and was happy or something. Like, and yeah, that could actually be just about my son and not just me wanting to be a teenager and meeting the girl of my dreams or something like that. It seems like Freud would have to say, if I had that kind of dream, it would be because I identify with the son.
I honestly don't know. And I don't know what he means by egotism here.
I thought that had to do with the identification thing that he explicitly gives an example. Okay, so he thinks that all dreams are wish fulfillment. So he gives a bunch of examples that people had given to him, his patients, like, you think all dreams are wish fulfillments. What about this? I dreamt that I wanted to have a supper, but I didn't get to have it. What do you think of that? I was foiled. And he delves into it, and it's, well, because the woman that was going to come to the supper wants to become stouter. And the patient's wife prefers this woman and prefers stouter women. And so by the woman not being able to come to the supper, she's not going to get stouter. And so the patient is actually going to get what she wants, which is to get her husband back.
Yeah, he also has a good example in this reading of the girl seeing her sister's only surviving child lying dead.
Yes.
But it turns out just to be the wish surrounding that is to see a man that she wants to see again, and that death would bring him to her or something.
To the funeral, yeah. She'd be at the funeral. That's the last time she saw him, was at the other kid's funeral. But even further than this, in this one as well, you know, so those are both good examples of that he uses to say, oh, it really is wish fulfillment, even though it's horrible. But I remember there was also an element in this one that the patient was also identifying herself with the friend because she wanted to be the loved object. So that's why I was bringing that up here, that really as soon as it looks like somebody else is the focus, like the friend is the focus of the dream, well, it's no, because you're the friend.
Oh, I see.
And that's one of the things that condensation and displacement, either of those could sort of feed into that. And one of the ways that he determines again that all dreams are egotistical, that, yeah, you would have to say you are the son if you have a dream about your son being happier or something. All right. So once he gets onto displacement, then the next section is on symbolism, right? Just the fact that a lot of these things that we come up with when we condense, when we displace, end up being movements toward either associations we have, right? Personal symbols. So to take something that happened from our childhood, some like building that we used to live in, or could be a symbol for a bad time we had or something like that. But then he also thinks that a lot of these symbols are not just personal, they're throughout the culture or just from human beings. So that's where he gets into these sexual symbols and going up a passage always means the vagina or tends to mean the vagina and stuff like that.
And this is where, to me, there was just a lot of tension between the first one, which seemed to be pretty straightforwardly latent meaning, which you were calling personal symbols or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then these symbols that are more like the historical, mystical dream interpretation, mm-hmm. where you would, as Wes, you know, you have a book, you say, well, let's look up what the things are that appear in your dream and I'll tell you what they mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I found there's just a lot of tension there in that for me. It's not clear to me that on this, it's very easy to have both of them.
This is, for me, the weakest part. Unless you can save this by talking about polyvalence and interpretive promiscuity. Well, in some sense, maybe everything concave is a vagina and maybe everything convex is a phallus just because the mind is so hyper-associative. And mm-hmm. sexuality is so fundamental a part of our being.
And we're all beavers and butthead.
That association is always there. That's one way of thinking about it. To me, the real significance of going up a staircase depends on the analysand's particular associations to that, their particular life experiences. Maybe it also means whatever Freud thinks it means.
If folks want to follow that farther, they can listen to our Carl Jung episode that we did a while ago, who really emphasizes this aspect in that there are a lot of symbols that are not personal and they're somehow as a result of being human itself.
Part of the cultural unconscious.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Do we want to say anything about Irma before we get out of here?
What's your guys' general reaction to his interpretation?
I described it briefly early on. We're not going to read the whole thing. It's longer than the one we already read, but he's a dream about this patient who didn't take his advice and didn't get all the way better. So in this dream, he sees her and she complains of symptoms and he's looking at her and she has all these weird scales in her throat and stuff that has nothing to do with the symptoms she actually displayed in real life. And these other doctor friends of his come along and say dumb things about her. And so the whole thing is supposed to absolve him of not treating her all the way, that, oh, well, she really has a medical ailment and it wasn't psychological at all. Or one of the friends who was involved in pointing out his possible negligence and not treating her all the way gave her an injection of something nasty and he's at fault for it. And another one is just a fool. And so the whole thing is sort of blaming her and blaming the other people and not him. And so that's why it's a wish fulfillment for him. Any other details that are worth?
Well, I thought the whole writing of it was pretty interestingly introspective. I mean, I think that you summarized sort of the bottom line dream analysis. Okay. It was very interesting to just read it and see him picking it apart. And then you could, in his writing, see him discovering the meaning of the dream itself. I'll just sort of take for granted that the writing that we have in front of us is, it at least reflects sort of his own experience of analyzing that dream. But he does a very nice job of making you feel like, wow, I'm discovering something as I go along about Sigmund Freud.
Yeah. One of the pieces I liked about it was he clearly is carrying a lot of remorse at recommending that a friend of his use cocaine.
He died.
Which The misuse of that drug had hastened the death of a dear friend of mine.
Listeners may not know that Freud was pioneered the use of cocaine.
Yes, cocaine and cigars. And there's just some very interesting. He's got one here where it says, part of the dream is that the patient looked pale and puffy. And he says, my patient always had a rosy complexion. I began to suspect that someone else was being substituted for her. And it's almost like a mystery. You're uncovering the clues and you're kind of working through this. And he makes a very convincing case that he has anxiety about. He wants to help people get better. He wants to give the right treatment. When he treats people and they don't get better, he's worked up about it. Or if he gives somebody a treatment and they don't respond positively, he's worked up about it. And the whole thing is prefaced by the point that he had been treating this patient and that she had gotten better, but that she wasn't fully better. And he receives a report from somebody who sees her, you know, in some other place and says, yeah, she looks okay, but she's still clearly not better. And the implication is that he has somehow failed. And so this whole thing is a really interesting meditation on his desire to heal all his patients, his anxiety about giving false or unhelpful advice. And then simultaneously, he clearly has an image problem. He's very affected by what other people think. He feels he's being judged on the basis of this person. And it was very entertaining, but it reminded me of reading The Purloined Letter, which I guess I should not be surprised at, since I'm sure there's literary and philosophical connections between Derrida, Lacan, Poe, and Freud. But it's a kind of example that makes you believe in the legitimacy of the approach. It's the kind of thing where it gives credibility, where you're like, well, there's nothing far-fetched about it. It's ex post facto, as Dylan said, but we don't have any other framework from which we can operate. And it's a great example of his, I think, very structured and rigorous approach, which is to take piece by piece, try to tease out if there's an immediate obvious meaning or if not, and if not, to ask what that might be pointing towards, and then to slowly start tying those things together.
So folks can just search on Irma's injection. I see it even has its own Wikipedia page and quotes the whole dream. So having listened to us talk about this for a while, you can go and experience a little yourself and see if you agree with Freud's analysis. And I think one of the reasons that this is, I think commentators have pointed this out, that this is maybe a more convincing account is because he doesn't get into any of the sexual stuff. This is the first thing. This is like right near the beginning. This is the beginning of chapter two. He's just in chapter one of the interpretation of dreams. He's giving the, here's what all the other philosophers thought about these basic things. And here's the first, he's just diving into the analysis for the first time. And so he's not going to pull out infantile sexuality and, oh, there was a head. It must have been a phallus. There's none of that. So makes it not so bad.
Oh, man. It has a real honesty about it.
What was impressive about this whole thing, if we're kind of moving toward closings here, is the functional teleological approach to the mind, to what the mechanisms must be within the mind. And so one thing that hasn't been said here is that so the overall function of the dream is to be the guardian of sleep, that if things are too painful, right, that the principle of pain or whatever, then, well, you would wake up. So the repression, just like it keeps you from getting into trouble and doing stupid things when you're awake, well, it keeps the disturbing stuff. It lets it out a little bit. It lets it blow off some steam. But it, by using these things to distort it, by using transference and condensation, it keeps it under control so that it doesn't wake you up. And so if you do have a dream that's horrible enough to wake you up, well, that's just actually, it's the dream tried to do its job, but the forces unleashed were just too great and they woke you up. And so that's, to get back to Dylan brought up trauma dreams before, that's what's going on there. That's actually a case, if you want to say all dreams are wish fulfillments, well, what about trauma dreams? Well, trauma dreams are trying to be wish fulfillments, but the trauma is just too great. So even having this recurring trauma dream is still better than it completely wrecking your life while you're awake.
No, it's not actually.
No? Okay, you want to tell us the right way?
I'm just saying I think everything you said is right. It's just not better than.
Oh, okay.
The dream, the people who have war traumas and they have these flashbacks and dream, I mean, that's part of what wrecks their lives. They can't sleep properly. They're constantly in this flashback state. And Freud's, the whole theory of his death drive comes from this. So later on, he revises his early ideas that the pleasure principle is the fundamental principle of how the mind works, this pleasure seeking kind of thing that the mind does. But the whole idea of the death drive that comes later is that, in fact, there are basic self-destructive forces at work in human beings, which are not reducible to pleasure-seeking, gone wrong, basically.
And that was actually one of the references when I did the search in the Freud Reader for Schopenhauer as one of the philosophical foundations behind the death drive, that people are destructive.
There's a lot of overlap also with Nietzsche's will to power. There's a lot of thinking to be done about the relationship between death drive and will to power.
There were some other things about this guardian of sleep thing, you know, so if you wake up to your alarm or something, you know, so that a lot of times these outside noises are incorporated into the dreams, that that's one way of the dream is trying, according to his analysis, is trying to let you keep sleeping, which is hard to verify because how do you determine that there was some noise that was successfully turned into, you know, some dog is barking. And so it's turned into a dog barking in the dream. So you don't wake up. And you keep sleeping for the rest of the night. How do you confirm that as opposed to when the dog is actually barking and does wake you up and, oh, a dog was barking in my dream, but then it turned out it was a real dog. It was because the dog barking in real life was just too persistent and invasive and your dream could not do what, according to Freud, it was trying to do, which is to convert it to something that would let you sleep. And he gives the example of somebody that has a really bad itch. And so he imagines the poultice that he's using to treat the itch as a saddle he's riding in the dream, something like this. Remember this example? Anyway, yeah. So instead of having like an irritating thing, you just have a dream that you're riding a horse. And so, yeah, you're going to feel some weird stuff when you're riding a horse in your crotch area. And that's just natural. And you can just keep on sleeping. Don't let that wake you up.
One of his fundamental ideas is that fantasy plays an important role psychically in the psychic economy, that it helps us cope with these internal stimuli, these desires. And so, for instance, infants, and this is the first act of symbolization, the first thing where people substitute something for the real thing in the world. So instead of mother or instead of actual breast in my mouth, I have a fantasy of that. Later on, it'll become a word. And the way, of course, we can regulate our own emotions as adults by saying, oh, I can't eat now, but I will eat later. That symbol or the fantasy of eating is enough of a gratification to calm me down until I can actually do that. But for an infant who doesn't have that ability, you see the result, which is abject, horrible crying.
Flailing around, yeah.
Until they can develop those abilities. So he's thinking that fantasizing and the function of fantasizing, that dreams are similar in that function, that they help regulate stimuli.
The overall picture of the function of the dream and how you could get at the homunculi, the different systems acting within the dream, I thought was extremely clever, if nothing else. So I enjoyed this quite a bit. Are there closings?
He's a tremendously good writer. It was very entertaining, as well as a very kind of seamless read, and that's important. There's the kind of outstanding question of, if you're not going to dig into all of the casework and use evidence-based practices to validate his theories, then we're left in a place where we can't necessarily make a judgment about the rightness or wrongness of the specifics, for example, of all the way the rules, the way analysis works. But I think this idea that the mind censors itself and that in sleep, the censorship is relaxed, and that's how dreams work. And that's also when the censorship is relaxed, it's also where you get disorders. So people who have censorship relaxed in their waking life, right, are the ones that have other disorders. I think that's really interesting, but it's also very troublesome, and not just because of the implications for this notion that we are able to somehow understand ourselves in a way that's meaningful. And this introduces an element of doubt, that we would have to constantly be in doubt of our own self-knowledge. It's that the fundamental structure of mind, the fundamental structure of identity or of self, is one of hiddenness instead of revealing. And what I mean by that is that there's an internal tension. This description of the mind as something that is protecting itself from itself. It's self-referential in a very interesting way that kind of brings one back to Kierkegaard. But it does so in a way, he recasts it not in a kind of neutral relation, but using this notion of hiddenness, using the term even censorship. I don't know what the German was originally, but it essentially casts us as beings who are simultaneously protective, but also kind of a little bit at war with ourselves. And maybe that's a more accurate description of what existence even is, but it's hard to swallow. It's hard to get comfortable with.
All right. So I'm going to say for my closing, I feel a little bit guilty because I think I was the censor in this whole situation. You guys might have liked to shit on Freud a little more than you got a chance to, but thanks for not doing that. You know, I take it sort of as axiomatic that people are self-deceived and don't know themselves very well by default, and that that is sort of a lifelong quest to get to know yourself better. Even before the advent of Freud, I think that was a pretty common idea. I just think Freud has new things to say about how you're deceiving yourself and how you undeceive yourself. So if you thought that philosophical reflection were the primary way to go, which is, I think, the way people thought, or the interpretation of literary texts, which I think people also thought was helpful for self-knowledge, and I think that's true. Here's a new method where the person becomes the text, and you learn a set of techniques for interpreting yourself and knowing yourself better. And they're more attuned to your emotional existence than, say, philosophical self-inquiry is. And you start asking questions about, you know, well, why was I actually feeling that way? Was it the reason I thought, or was it something else? From personal experience, it's a worthy method of self-discovery and fascinating and so on and so forth. And the final thing I want to say is that every once in a while, there is an article that says, oh, Freud's alive and well, or there's actually an article in the April issue of Discover magazine called The Second Coming of Sigmund Freud. And these seem to come out on an annual basis. But this Discover magazine one is about the neuroscientists investigating the link between Freudian ideas and neuroscience, including this guy, Mark Solms. And so, for instance, they look at the analogy between the way the frontal cortex interacts with the limbic system as the interaction between ego and id, and so on and so forth. You know, inhibitory mechanisms that occur that prevent us simply from doing whatever impulse comes from the limbic system that says we should do. And I think that's great. I think that's going to be a very scientifically rewarding kind of pursuit when you start looking at whether and how actual brain mechanisms line up with these theories that are, you know, as you guys pointed out, incomplete and not verifiable because they focus on the introspective part of things. I think the more connections you can draw between the introspective and the actual structure of the brain, the more you'll find out about how these mechanisms actually work.
Well, I'm glad that we're not at the Oscars, because if you're giving your Oscar speech and it's late at night and it's closing and people want to stop and you use the word limbic system, then they start playing the music. You have to stop right there.
Yeah, I'm also glad.
Next time, we're going to talk about the play Antigone by Sophocles and look for our performance of that.
But before the Antigone episode comes out, you're going to want to come to the after show for this episode. That'll be Sunday, June 7th at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. If you are a PEL citizen, you can go sign up at partiallyexaminedlife.com to attend. Wes is going to be there. Our host, Danny Lobel, will be there. It'll be a great time. If you're not familiar with the after shows, citizens can go look at the free stuff page at partiallyexaminedlife.com. They're all there. They're a hoot. We are supported by your donations. While you're at partiallyexaminedlife.com, why don't you make a contribution? Big donors since last time have included Dark Sea England, Brian Calendra, Judy Upjohn, Adrian Cho, Will Parker, Joe Wexler, Corey Moeller, Leland Gregory, Ryan Anderson, Alan Poindexter, Ian Hayden, Andrew Lavin, Brenda Ewer, and Melissa Rohal. Thanks also to the many smaller donors, including those who are on a newly or continued basis signed up for a $5 a month citizen site. If you can't afford $5 a month, you can still support the PartiallyExaminedLife.com. We now have an account on Patreon.com. That is Patreon.com. Look up the Partially Examined Life. You can give as little as $1 a month, which will still be a huge help for us. And please, of course, spread the word about the podcast.
And thank you and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Now